This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good morning, everyone! Or good afternoon, or whatever. I don't even know what we're on.
Still morning.
Okay, we're starting. I'm Rachel, for whoever doesn't know. And we're going to look at something that's somewhat like mundane, but I hope will be interesting. And that is the Manishtana, which in English we like to call a lot the four questions, but that by the end I think we'll have to change that title, the number most specifically. But hopefully this will lead to some thoughts, not just about the questions themselves, but about the experience of the Seder and what Chazal imagined the experience of the Seder should be. So that's what I want to look at. In the Torah itself, there four times it actually tells us that there is a mitzvah to retell the story of the Exodus to our children. And it's clearly something very central to the experience of nationhood and that definition of who we are as a people, and to sort of, that is an essential core aspect of what the future generations need to know about what it means to be part of the Jewish people. And so that idea is it reiterated over and over again. And one of the main places where this sort of plays out is in the Seder itself. So I'm sure you guys are all familiar, I would imagine, with the four questions as they appear in the Seder itself. What are they? You don't have to sing them, but just what are they? Let's just review. Do you count that as one of your questions? That's the effect. Okay. So then you'll get more. You might get more. That would be like one question. And then there's a subset. Okay. I'm less concerned with the number of them. But what are they? What is there? Wait, hold on. Let's like listen. Hello. Welcome. Eating matzah, dipping twice, reclining, maror. So, matzah, maror, dipping twice, reclining. And how many of those questions get answered during the Seder? Leaning gets answered? How does leaning get answered? That might be an explanation we give, but that is not anywhere in the Seder, right? So we have this fascinating phenomenon where at the beginning of the Seder, like the little kid stands up and, you know, this is all focused on the child center and asks these questions. And then we're not even clear if they get answered. Oh, wow. Look who's here.
They're
Ayala's parents. They're not Ayala's in-laws. Welcome. Come. Are there more chairs? Yeah. I was assigned the baby, Josh. I moved myself.
We were sitting in there.
Oh, you're so popular. You don't ever do that.
I'm sorry. No, because it's so, I feel like it's too open, the baby, Josh. It's too hard to give.
It is hard to hear.
I just felt like I couldn't imagine I would have so many people that the place would be full.
Thank you.
And I wanted us to be able to do chavruta, and I wanted Mish to be able to do chavruta.
Tony, was that for you?
No.
Okay. Come on in.
You have one for yourself?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Tony.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's my fault for choosing this.
Is there any more? I'm going to awkwardly be sitting here right now. I was in the basement.
Okay, we won't be awkward. We'll be next to each other. Okay, I'm sorry. And actually, very soon we're all going to move because we're going to go to the baby trash. But I just felt like it was too big there, and I also wanted Mish to be able to do chavruta if she wanted. I'm not a fan of. Okay, so to recap, the four questions that we say traditionally at the Seder are matzah, maror, why do we dip twice, and reclining. Now, as we just saw from asking, when I asked how many people, well, like which one of these questions get answered, there was some hesitation about that. People were like, I think matzah gets answered.
You, Amaya, thought that maybe Mara got answered. You were for reclining. We'll see. I don't. You have a reason for it, but I don't know if it's in the Seder. And does dipping get answered?
No. And it wasn't even. And it wasn't originally.
Well, we're going to get to if it's originally or not. And that's so. Let's get. So we see that there's something weird. On the one hand, we want the child to be interested. You interest children by asking them questions, but then there's something awkward about the fact that they. Like, if they ever made it up to the end of the Seder, they might be kind of annoyed, like, you know, you had me memorize these questions and ask them, and then you never answered them. It's not the best educational tool. The second thing is, the language of one of the questions is somewhat awkward. Do you remember the question? I can pass this out. You can actually have the text now in front of you. We can pass that out. Anyone think of anyone that the language is somewhat awkward? The dipping one. What's awkward about the dipping? We don't even dip once tonight. Like, do we dip twice? So if some editor was looking at this, they would have said, why don't you just say, on all other nights we don't dip, tonight we dip. Right? That's the same thing as we don't even dip once, tonight we're dipping twice. Like, what's going on there? It's quite an awkward language. Okay. So these are my introductory questions, and what I hope that I will be able to show you. What I hope that I'll be able to show you, or you'll be able to show yourself from learning the text, is what the original questions are, what we've lost in our understanding of not having them exactly as they are in the original, and I hope to reveal or reconnect to what I think that the rabbi's original understanding of the structure of the Seder was and the questions themselves. So we are going to now get up and go to the Beit Midrash. What you should have in front of you, and if you don't, we don't have enough, I can Xerox more. Is it just happened to be folded. It's fine.
We're short one.
Okay, I'll make you a Xerox in 1 second.
No, just take this, we can share.
Okay.
Thank you. One
magic. So what we're going to look at is we're going to look at how the Mishnah appears in the printed versions of the Mishnah. But I want to remind you that don't take that so literally, because the printed versions of the Mishnah actually get very affected by our printed versions of the Haggadah. There's like a go-between between both of them. The Haggadah influences the Mishnah. Obviously, originally, the Mishnah influenced the Haggadah. Right? For all those who don't know, and I think people have been in lots of classes, the structure for our Seder is in Masechet Psachim of the Mishnah, the 10th chapter of Masechet Psachim. If we had all day, I would love to talk about Masechet Psachim. It's a really interesting Masechet. It has 10 chapters to it. The first Mishnah in the first chapter, I don't know how many people remember it or ever learned it, it starts Or La'abar Asrei. It's talking about doing Bedikat Chametz on the night of the 14th. That's the first Mishnah of the first chapter. And only by the 10th chapter, which is the last chapter, do we get to Leil HaSeder, which is one night later, the night of the 15th. And in fact, the entire Masechet is going to end at midnight on the 15th, which we're going to talk about in a second. If anyone knows what I'm referring to, you'll understand. So it's like a fascinating Masechet. It's all about the holiday of Pesach, but like you basically don't get there ever in the playing out of time. And these things, I think, are not coincidental of how Chazal are structuring their thought process. So the whole 10th chapter, though, talks about the night of the 15th. And in that chapter, we have Mishnah number 3 and 4, which is what you're going to look at closely. So you're going to go to the Beit Midrash. You're going to look at Mishnah 3 and 4. You're going to turn the page. You're going to look at a little bit of Masechet Psachim, which it sounds like you, because you're in Misha's class, know a little bit about, where the Amoraim are going to discuss the dipping question. I have questions for you to think about, but it's clear that the Babylonians do not have any idea how they ate in Eretz Yisrael. And they have a lot of trouble, and they're the ones who are going to change the language of the dipping question. Then you're going to look at a Mishnah for Masechet Brachot that's going to deal with the leaning question. And then you're going to look at how the Mishnah that you already had looked at in the printed versions appears in the manuscripts and in the Jerusalem Talmud, which, in my opinion, is the clear, change-fixed text. And then you're going to look at one more Mishnah for Masechet Psachim. Each of these texts has some questions that you should think about with your chavruta, and you are going to do that for half an hour, 40 minutes, and then we're going to come back and have a conversation, okay? Don't, like, rush through them by this, like, reading the English and then tell me in 3 minutes you're done. Sit with your chavruta. You could use the English, but try to, like, see what are, like, these are actually a little bit nuances. What are the differences in the questions? Because small things are going to make a difference, okay? Any questions about what we're about to do? That's the plan. If anyone wants to stay here and do the learning, that's fine, but we're all going to get a chavruta, the person sitting next to us, someone near us, and we're going to learn these texts. Okay, here we go. Yeah. I've tried not to touch anything. It recorded all the silence in the room this whole time. It's going to be a terrible recording. No one's going to want to listen to it, but whatever. Okay, here we go. I hope this will be interesting if it wasn't yet interesting. Okay, the Mishnah, right, presents the Manish Torah in the flow of the Seder. At one point, does this happen? Simple, straightforward question.
After the second cupboard.
After the second cupboard, and after what else? When is the kid supposed to be asking these questions?
After the second cup of wine.
It's poured.
After the second cup of wine is poured, and what else? what does the Mishnah say?
After the food is prepared, brought to the table.
After the food is brought to the table.
Is it eaten or just brought?
I think it may be laid out. I don't know if they've eaten it yet. But first, I just want to point out to you in the problems with the questions the way we ask them, right? No kid would ask about the leaning and the dipping unless they had memorized the questions beforehand, because they haven't seen the leaning or the dipping yet, right? The thing is so awkward how we do it. I find it so frustrating, you're going to see. Like, right, the whole concept of wanting to get a child interested and wanting them to ask questions is that there at least should be triggers, and that the questions should be grounded in something, in a reality, right? When a three-year-old memorizes, why do we dip or not dip? It's only maybe if they learned in kindergarten something about the dipping, they know why. But it's just set out of the blue because they memorize it. We don't have any food on the table. We have not dipped a thing. We haven't leaned it yet, right? And it's very disconnected. Here, these questions are questions that happen in a context, but right? The food is spread on the table. Yeah.
But there is some leaning.
Possibly with the wine, with the kiddush, yeah. Correct. It was said there, at least that. We're going to see that wasn't the original. But it is still, in some ways, the way we do it today, right? Because we sit in these kind of chairs and then we do this awkward thing which is totally uncomfortable and not.
What did they actually say before this in the
Flow of the Mishnah? The Mishnah beforehand talks about kiddush. It's a Mishnah that appears both in Brachot and in here. It tells you the machloket by Chama and Bethelo about how you say Kiddush.
But there's no Maggid. There's no discussion before this then.
No, this is the beginning of Maggid.
Okay.
We're at the beginning.
I'm wondering if the questions just came later.
No, meaning Maggid happens in the Mishnah. This also makes more sense. This is not during the meal. Meaning, it's not that you're sitting starving. I don't know how it is in other families. It's not that you're sitting starving for hours talking and counting the pages till you're finally going to eat. It's that how normal meals work. You eat and you talk and you talk and you eat and you tell a story over food and over wine. And we've taken the Seder and we formalized it in a way that I find very painful, because it's me lost a lot of its original intent. But so the food is spread on the table, right? The vegetables are there, and the maror is there, and the korban pesach is there, and then we pour the wine, because the maggid's supposed to be told over a cup of wine. I think it really means that idea, like, of let's relax and let's sip the wine and let's tell the story, and definitely there's an experiential part that we have to focus on. And then the Mishnah says, here's where the kid will ask, right? And I assume that means the kid, without the father prompting, if we hadn't had these memorized things, the table is set, and the kid will start to notice things that are slightly different. He or she might want his yummy challah and instead see something flat and be like, wait a second, where's the challah, right? Or, although probably then their matzah was much yummier than ours. But the fact of the food will be the impetus for asking the questions, and the beginning of the story will be the impetus for asking the questions. What's interesting here is, right, then the Mishnah says, it depends on the level of the kid. And I don't think it means necessarily, like, how brilliant he is. Diet has to do with, are you talking to a 3-year-old? Are you talking to a 7-year-old? Are you talking to a 10-year-old? Right, those conversations and those type of questions are going to be different. But if the kid doesn't have dot, which to me means they're a younger child, right, then the family, the parent, starts pointing something out. And it, to me, the language is perfect. It's, what's funny is I don't actually think the 4 things or the 3 things or whatever are actually questions. I think the question is just, you know, oh, Sarah, do you see what's different about tonight? Let's look. Do you see we're eating matzah. We don't usually eat matzah. Right? Those aren't asked as questions. Those are made as points, which is totally how you would talk to a 3-year-old, right, or a 2-year-old. You'd say, look, do you notice anything different? And then, which isn't said in the Mishnah, the kid might go, wait, why? Right? There would still be a question that the child would then ask. Why are we eating matzah? But these aren't questions. These are pointing out the differences that are seen. That's how I'm reading it. Okay, so, but what are the things we're pointing out? So in this written text, what do we point out and how is it different? In the printed text of the Mishnah, what do we point out and how is it different from what we say?
Chametz
u matzah, same.
Dipping,
is it the same as what we say?
No.
How's it different?
It
says on all other nights we dip once, tonight we're dipping twice. So already in the printed version of the Mishnah and in the manuscript, it's different than ours. Why did that question change?
Because we moved to
Babylonia. And apparently there were differences in the eating habits of the Babylonians. Nachon, right, if you saw in source number 3. And as Uri wants to point out, not just different eating habits, like totally in oblivia that there could be another practice or an understanding that people might have different customs at all. So the Babylonian Amoraim have the text that says, on all other nights we dip once, tonight we're dipping twice. And they say, huh? On all other nights we dip once? Never heard of such a thing. What, we have to dip once on all other nights? What are you talking about? I don't understand. And they clearly do not understand the text. And then they start trying to fix it, right? It really means fix it, saying, oh, this is what the Mishnah must have said, right? And Rava says, well, maybe it is that it's about an obligation to dip. And then Rav Safra says something that has, at least in my experience, become the understanding of the dipping. What does Rav Safra think the reason we do this first dipping?
Obligation.
No, he rejects obligation. He said, well, you're going to have an obligation because why? Because of the kids. He thinks this dipping is just like, let's do something funny that's kind of weird, so the kids will go, huh, what's going on here? Right? It's like a trigger, a pole, no, a hook, a something, what do we call it? Like a
bait.
What we call it, right? That he assumes the reason you're doing the dipping is for the kids, and then he says, "What? That can't be obligatory. It can't be obligatory to like do something queer for the kids, weirdo for the kids, right?" So, and he fixes the language. What's nice about his fix is it's the fix that least changes the language, right? He just slips in that word "ain," which makes it good for him, and he preserves most of the time, right? If we were talking about, if we were doing a class on all the times the Babylonian Amoraim changed the Mishnah, they do. But they don't like to, like, rewrite it completely. They like to make changes that preserve as much as they can, right? Because they're having a problem. They receive the tradition like this. This is how they have the Mishnah. They don't understand it, and they're grappling with it. So we have 2 things. We get put in the Ain because they don't understand that they used to dip, right? And in Eretz Yisrael, this wasn't something special for Pesach. That's how the Mediterranean diet was. They had a salatim course. They took their carrots, they dipped it in their hummus, they took their, they didn't have tomatoes then, did they?
No.
That's a new one. What's old world vegetables? Carrots are probably, mashed up beans, they dipped lettuce into, they had a vegetable dipping course. Everyone had that course. They had it on Tuesday night, they had it on Friday night for Shabbat, and they also had it at the Seder, right? Just the same way I imagine in most of your homes at the Seder, you also have a soup course. Right? I know, at least on Friday, we have matzo balls, chicken soup. We also happen to have that soup course on Friday night. The fact that we have it at the Seder is just because
that's how we start big meals. We have a soup course or a starter course, right? And so we do the same thing. Same thing for them. They had a vegetable course. They had a vegetable course. The Babylonian Amorim did not have a vegetable course. They do not understand the vegetable course dipping. And so they say it's this thing to engage the kids, which just sort of infuriates me more because, so you do this kind of funny thing, a little song and dance. Hi, are you paying attention? And then the kids are like, yeah, we're here. And then they say, okay, so what do you want to say? And you say, oh, we just did a funny thing, so you pay attention. Does that help? And if you think about it, so what in our Seder today, what is that vegetable dipping course? How do we imitate the vegetable dipping course?
Karpas,
which is also a very awkward, I don't know, maybe you have more progressive ways of doing it. In my family, it was this whole stress because halachically you're not supposed to eat too much because you haven't washed yet. And so, yeah, are you saying a bracha? Are you not saying a bracha? I think now there's more of an opening maybe brought in from the other denominations of having really a vegetable dipping course, which kind of solves the problem of the being starving while you're talking. But in our family, it was like a little piece of potato. Husband's family, in England, they did parsley, which I can't do parsley because you're supposed to do potato. But so now we have that both. But and the whole salt water thing, we put the salt water because we wanted to at least try to give it some meaning, right? Of the tears of the Egyptian, of the Jews, of being Egyptian slaves. I think they were dipping into hummus or whatever mashed up bean thing. Okay. So we have question number one that gets changed because they didn't understand the eating habits. And we'll come back to that in 1 second of what the original question was. What was the other thing that gets changed in the... slightly worried. I'm going to finish this really quickly. Meat. What was the original question about?
Why
roasted only? That's the Paschal sacrifice. Paschal sacrifice has to be only roasted. That's what the Torah says. So on other nights, you might have a beef stew. You might have a cooked something. On this night, we're only eating roasted meat. Sorry, vegetarians. And that means it's a question about Korban Pesach. That would mean it's a question about Korban Pesach. Now, what's not here is there's no leaning question, right? And the why is it that the Mishnah kid would not ask a leaning question?
Because you always did it.
Because if you see from the Mishnah Brachot, which is in the chapter just about the laws of the Su'udah, of meals in general, that's how you had a big family meal. In Mishnah times, based, I presume, on Greek culture, right? You leaned if you were eating together, right? This Mishnah is talking about how to say Birkat HaMazon. So sometimes you ate in a rush where everyone's like eating on their own and then you don't join together for Birkat HaMazon. But if you're going to spend some time at the meal, right, which I assume it also involves some wine and some talking, you're going to be reclined, which is showing that we're gotten together and the purpose of what we're here for is to eat. And then you do Birkat HaMazon together. So I assume in the Mishnah child's life, Friday night dinner, they probably reclined. And on Sukkot, they probably reclined. And on Thanksgiving dinner, they probably reclined. Right? That's what it means to have a meal. So when they showed up at the Seder, for sure they knew that this is going to be like a more formal, you know, like serious meal. But they wouldn't have said, like, why another night? What I imagine happened... The formulation of the question as we have it, of on all of the nights we don't lean, is in the Rambam's Haggadah, in Maimonides' Haggadah. My guess of what happened was that we continued to do the Seder as our ancestors had done it. And so they had a vegetable dipping course, we had a vegetable dipping course. They leaned, right? And so we kept leaning. But at a certain point, we stopped leaning at all our other meals. And then the leaning became different and significant, and something a child might ask about. Right, and then we start giving an explanation. We're like kings. We're like free people. Right? Is that what you were told while you lean? So one of the chavrutot, I forget who I was talking to. I apologize. Said, "Would even poor people have?" Was with you, Susie? Right. Would even like in the time in the Mishnah, would poor people have leaned? And we sort of together talked it out that we imagined probably yes, meaning they might have been lying on a mat, but if it was a meal that they were going to spend more time at, they put themselves in a position to be open to spending more time at it. And that's the reclining. Not everyone had one of those chaise lounge with a servant holding the grapes over their mouth.
They probably had one table they had this little bit.
Right? But do you think it, there probably were some people who probably were poor that they just had mats?
That's probably true.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if the idea of, like, having a big dining room table, someone, I think that's much later, medieval times. Yeah.
So I have Yemenite cousins, and they do have a seder pretty much on the floor. And
yeah?
They have, like, lots of cushions and stuff.
That's fun.
Cool.
That would definitely be a way to get kids involved and interested. And would be, in some ways, more comfortable. I've heard of people who, like, start at the couch and don't move to the table. That's but just it's so uncomfortable, so long. All right. So we now know that the Mishnah child would not have asked the leaning question. Leaning question gets substituted when we're not asking a Korban Pesach question. And the main thing that we have to figure out is what was going on with the dipping. Okay. So I've asked a few chavrutas this, but people are having trouble with this. I want my water bottle. If during Mishnah times they always did a vegetable dipping course, excuse me for one second. What is the second dipping? What's the second dipping that the kid is asking about?
During the maror.
The second dipping that the child is asking about is the dipping of the maror. Right? Meaning, they're used to bringing out vegetables and dipping them. And then they're used to, like, the main course, which normally you might use your bread to eat or do something dipping, but you don't normally use vegetables then again, apparently. And yet, the parent has said we're going to have some more vegetable. And the kid's like, and not only that, we're going to dip it in this thing called haroset. And the child's like, I don't understand. You've been teaching me table etiquette my whole life. We don't usually have a second dipping course, right? So the kid doesn't even know to say the word maror because all the kid sees on the table is some more vegetables, right? Growing up in America, horseradish, which is not a... Wait, it's not a bitter herb, it's actually sharp. Those two words are different. In Israel, romaine lettuce, in my opinion, much better.
But is that really bitter?
At the root, I think it is. You know where it that
the
whiter part of the
root?
Yeah, the part you usually take off when you're making a salad,
exactly.
Right? So a lot of Israelis use romaine lettuce because that was the pshat of it. But eating... The kid is seeing some more lettuce on the table. The kid doesn't even know to say the word maror, but the child understands that something's weird going on with vegetables. And so when the child asks about why are we doing the second dipping, the child is asking about maror. I'm pretty sure that that is the pshat of that question. But the Babylonians don't understand the dipping. They think it's about making kids interested, and then at some point, and I don't know where, because I don't have it, I mean, I have it in our Haggadah, someone says, but wait, why don't we have a maror question, and they add in a maror question into the printed versions of the Mishnah and into our Haggadah, because it makes sense to ask a maror question, and they thought none was asked. But if you look in source number 5, how the Mishnah appears in the Yerushalmi, right, what the thing about the Yerushalmi is the Yerushalmi isn't learned very much. It hasn't been learned for all those thousands of years. So it doesn't get corrupted in the way the regular Babylonian, right? It's the same Mishnah that appears in the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. But the Babylonian Talmud Mishnah has been corrupted by our knowledge of the Haggadah. Right? People know the Haggadah, they say it. Then they get to the Mishnah, they see they're mirroring the Haggadah, but there's something different here, and so they make some changes between the two. This, how it appears in the Jerusalem Talmud, no one's learned it, so no one makes any changes to it. And it was easy for me to bring it to you, but if you also check the manuscripts, if you put in Mishnah manuscripts, you go to Hebrew site, you can easily check the manuscripts of this Mishnah. This is how it appears in the manuscripts. How many questions are there in the original Mishnah? Three statements, right? Which are now what? What are they?
Dipping,
which is what? What we just said is a statement about maror. And then it's also matzah. And then it is
meat,
which is Pesach. Right? So those words, Pesach, matzah, maror, those are central themes to our Yitziat Mitzrayim story. Right? No more of this, like, let's just do something funny that we're not going to talk about. Yes?
The order is different.
The order is different than Pesach, matzah, and maror.
Yes.
The order is Mara Matzah Pesach.
Right.
Yes. I think that might be because that might be, in some ways, like how you eat them. Well, we eat the matzah. I don't know what.
Leah did something about this earlier.
About the order?
Yeah,
what did she say?
She said the order is written like this. She didn't say why. But then she said, but it makes more sense if we look at the foods as what they represent. Because matzah changes to the bitterness of slavery.
The thing is, when Rabbi Gamliel talks about them, he switches the order. I don't have a good answer. If we can come up with a good thing about the importance of the order, I don't have.
Well,
they ate the Pesach al matzot marim yochlu. They ate it as a sandwich, right? It was the hamburger, and then the condiment, a little like coleslaw, right? That's the maror, and then the bread, right? Meaning. Besides the maror having significance, it's like we too put on sometimes like sharp or sting. We put on mustard. We put mustard. Maybe it was a mustard, right? We take meat. We take two slices of bread and we put a condiment with it. Right? That's how we. That's how they ate the korban pesach.
I think in terms of going back to the original yitzhak, that's right.
I think that's the that
we
almost.
We can have a sandwich.
It says has the pesach go? Amatodim arim yachlu, right? They said that you do it with, that's a pesach from the Torah.
Okay, because I thought, okay.
That Hillel made a sandwich, Zecher L'tziyat Mitzrayim, that's without the, hikarchotam. I'm pretty sure that they ate them together from the pesach.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know exactly what they did. I just have the pesach.
They prepared the korban pesach 3 days in advance. They got the lamb and so on. They did it that evening.
Correct.
And then they rushed out with their matzah. But I'm not sure where the...
Oh, you're saying in Yetziat Mitzrayim, did they eat the korban?
Oh, yeah, they ate the korban that night. That was there.
Right, but you're saying... I'm misunderstanding what you were saying to me. You're actually saying on the night of Yetziat Mitzrayim, did they eat the korban pesach? Did they eat it with bread? Probably maybe not. But quite early on, the Torah itself says when you're recreating this, this is how you should eat it. I misunderstood what you're saying. Okay. So now we have the kid. So the food is brought to the table. The food are the main elements of the Seder. And then the kid is instructed to, like the parent points out, look at these differences. This is, this is going to be a different meal. Presumably then the child says, like, why? What's going on here? And then in the next Mishnah, and this happens in our Haggadah, then we have Rabbi Gamliel's key statement. And I don't know if whatever you've said this, if you've wondered about Rabbi Gamliel's statement, he says a very interesting thing. He says, Haya Omer, Kol Shelo Amar Shoshad Vrim Elu B'Pesach Lo Yetzai Yedei Chovato. Now I remember being much younger and thinking, what does he mean, anyone who doesn't say these three things hasn't fulfilled their obligation? Shouldn't it be anyone who doesn't eat these three things doesn't fulfill their obligation? Right, you could say, well, maybe already it's post-Mikdash, he wasn't eating Pesach, so that's a... But I actually think I would like to read it now, that he, Yotzei Yedei Chovato is the chiyuv of telling it to your kids. You have, when you're telling it to your kids, there are three main elements you have to focus on, and you need to explain that these foods aren't just to fill our tummies because we're hungry. These foods have meaning. They're symbols of our experience, right? And we could spend time, if we wanted, looking at which aspect of the experience, right? Is it, and it's definitely how God has helped us, right? It's not this that we were oppressed and we're running out. It's that we're being redeemed, right? It's not, it's the idea that God saves us and from the experience of this bitter experience. And so what's beautiful is if you look at how, right, he says, say these three things. He tells you what you should say. And then it says at the end, right, because it says, B'chol dovador chayav adam lirot et atzmo ke'ilu hu yatzam mimitzrayim shene'emar v'igata lebincha b'yom hahu le'mor. Right, so because in every generation you have an obligation to have this experience and you have to tell it to your child. So we have the pasuk that talks about telling to the child right here. But there's a very interesting link between these two things, right? B'tzeitzi mimitzrayim, I'm supposed to feel the experience, even though Rabbi Gamliel kept talking about avotenu, avotenu, avotenu. Right, and our forefathers. So how am I merging these two together? So here's the next thing I want to say about what the experience of the Seder, in my mind, is supposed to be. It's clear, these two values that you know about Jews, that it's about the food and it's about what we say about the food, right? And what do I mean, though, it's a clear it's about the food? I'm hoping you know something. If you don't, like, really, if I wanted to get this year well, we would have learned all the Mishnayot in the chapter that talk about the Seder. We didn't have that much time, so we're not. But if some people in some classes learned it, the first Mishnah, are people here in Misha's class who learned it? The first Mishnah of the chapter tells you an important thing about food. It says from the Mincha period on the 14th, what's supposed to happen?
Don't eat.
And very far at the... What? Right, but you're not supposed to eat. It says don't eat from Minchan on. And then at the second to last Mishnah, at the very end of the chapter, when people are half falling asleep, and if you fall asleep, what does it say to you? Did you get to do the last Mishnah?
Yeah.
It says don't eat. So you right, if you have don't eat. And if you after you eat the afikoman, don't eat. So the chapter is bound by telling you before the Seder don't eat. And after the Seder, don't eat, which is a symbol to me that says, because I want you to really experience the eating at the Seder by telling you not to eat before, not to eat after. It says, I want this eating experience to be different, right? It's going to be different because I'm going to really feel the taste of the food because I'm going to be hungry. But the chapter defines for me by saying that the eating is important. If you read through the chapter, many of the verbs are about pouring and bringing and eating. They're all about food verbs. And the other verbs are all about saying, and you saw these 10 verbs here of love, don't love, etc. So this, to me, is very interesting because I feel like the Seder is a beautiful transition that we see in the experience of what Rabbinic Judaism is about, is that in the time of the Mikdash, the main way we did Avodah, we think about it as korbanot, but it's also with eating, right? You ate the korbanot, kohanim ate the korbanot, certain parts of the korbanot, depending on what they were, human beings ate. Part of our actual religious experience was through eating. When we don't have the mikdash anymore, a lot of our religious experience becomes through talking, tefillah, and learning. And the Seder is a place where we actually link these two, and we're sort of transitioning through them. Okay, so here's the other thing I want to say. I think that it's not just that when we just eat Petzach, Matzah, and Maror, and Rabbi Gamliel says these things, and we haven't eaten yet, it's not just that we say that they symbolize something. I think we're supposed to actually viscerally experience it, right? We eat something bitter, and we feel the bitter. How is it that we're supposed to feel like we were out of Mitzrayim? I think we're trying to create the visceral experience of that as we eat it. We feel the bitterness on our body. We eat the flat bread and we understand that this is something about the experience like they experienced it. And this actually, right, for all those educators, right, when you're educating kids, it's always better if there's like if they're actually bodily involved in it. If it's not just in your head, if there's an experiential part to the learning. So we want to tell Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim to our kids, and we want to say we're going to eat these things, and these things have meaning, and we're going to tell you the meaning, and you're going to experience it, right? I put this as a side thing, but I just think it's interesting. I don't think it's by chance that the way Christianity tells the story of the Last Supper, which in theory is supposed to be the Pesach, is supposed to be Leil Seder, right? Jesus does the same thing. He gives different symbolism. He said the bread is going to mean something else and the wine is going to mean something else. But it's the same thing. When you eat the Eucharist, right, you're experiencing it in your body. He took the same food because he understood what Chazal understood because they're all thinking the same thing, right? That the food can create a visceral experience in your body that you can feel the experience of what it's supposed to symbolize. And I want to say one more thing. Oh, I'm probably going to run out of time. I'm probably going to have 5 minutes extra. But I want to say something about the four cups because we haven't mentioned them and the kids didn't mention them. I think it's not unique. Chazal drank wine all the time. But here it's structured that we're drinking four cups of wine. And we're drinking these four cups of wine, and I presume that the experience on their body is also being affected by the wine, right? And especially if you have an empty stomach. Right, and you start out with two cups of wine, and then you have some food, and you're it's getting later, and you start to feel that the Mishnah talks that people are going to probably fall asleep, but you're starting to feel a little woozy and a little spacey and a little, you know, out of this world, and then a very interesting thing happens in the chapter of the Mishnah, and it's reflected in our Seder. We start to say hallel. But we say hallel in a very awkward way, in a way that we've never said hallel in any other place, is that we break it up. We do part of the hallel. It seems they were doing it while they were eating, and we do it that we pause and then we eat, right? And then we say Birkat HaMazon, and then we say the end of the hallel, right? And that's a very bizarre thing, to like do part hallel, and then it's another example of like words and food and words, but what's going on? And not only do we break up the hallel, we say a bracha in the middle. I don't know how familiar you are with the Haggadah or with the Mishnah, but we say the first two paragraphs of the hallel, then we do our finishing up our meal thing, and then we say this bracha, and then we go on. Does anyone remember what the bracha is about? If you knew the Mishnah, does anyone know what that bracha is about? Do you remember it? No, that's this Denala Michya type of, that's for the is after we say Berkat HaMazon, when we say, does anyone remember what the bracha we say in the middle of Hallel is? I should have maybe put it on the source sheet. It's in your Haggadahs if you have a full text of the Haggadah. Come on, Robert. Pressure's on. All right. We say a bracha that's Baruchat Hashem Goel Yisrael.
Oh, yeah.
We say a bracha about redemption, which is very bizarre. So I want to tell you something about the visceral, physical experience that you're supposed to be feeling. For those people who learn the Mishnah, right, you're not supposed to eat after the Afikoman, right? So the Afikoman's at the end of the meal. And what time are you supposed to finish the Afikoman by in the Mishnah? Do you know? Chatzot. So I want you to imagine the timing that's happening of this meal. I'm viscerally experiencing the bitter slavery, and I'm viscerally experiencing the moments of redemption, right? And then I say the first two paragraphs of Hallel. What is the second paragraph of Hallel? B'tzei Yisrael Mimitzrayim. I say B'tzei Yisrael Mimitzrayim, and I'm timing that presumably with the end of my meal, because that, right, in a second I'm going to say Birkat HaMazon, right? Not the way we spot, right? And that's timed with midnight. What happened at midnight? That's when we left Mitzrayim. So we say B'tzei Yisrael Mimitzrayim, we time it with the moment of the Exodus at midnight. Presumably, we're feeling the euphoria in our bodies. We're tipsy on the wine. We're full with the meal, right? And then we say a bracha on geula, on experiencing the redemption. And there's a machloken in the Mishnah. Are we saying the bracha only on the past redemption? We hold actually the Rabbi Akiva that we're saying it hopefully for the future redemption. And so now we have like a completely different understanding of the experience of the Seder, which I feel very sad because I feel like we've lost it today. We've lost it. The experience of the Seder is a way to tell the story to our kids so they really feel it, and we ourselves feel it, right? Think about a great storyteller. A great storyteller is someone who pulls you in so you feel the fear of, like, what's going to happen when the door opens, right? And a great storyteller is where you're shuddering with the fear and you're excited when the good things happen. And so the Seder is doing everything to create this experience for our children and for us of saying, what's different about this night? What did the Jewish people experience on this night, and how do I feel it myself? And I feel it myself by taking these two aspects of what Jews have, of how we do Avodat Hashem. I'm eating special food, and I'm imbuing the food with meaning by what I say about it. And then that, in turn, is making me experience Yetziat Mitzrayim on my body. And I am getting to the moment of Chatzot, and I'm singing about being Yetziat Mitzrayim, and I'm feeling full, and I'm feeling warm, and I feel like Hashem is all around me. And to me, it's like a way of tangibly experiencing it, and I make a bracha on Geula. And so that is what I understand this parak in the Mishnah to be telling me, what the experience of a Seder is. And it's nothing detached from reality, and it's not just memorizing something, and it's not just waiting for the pages to be turned. And so I encourage you all, like I've encouraged myself, it's hard because we have Seder with family, and family has all sorts of rules about like what they want and whatever. But in the few times when I've had the opportunity to try to be in control of my Seder, I've tried to make some changes to go back to this experience of what it's supposed to be about. So I encourage you, if you have that opportunity, to make your Seder be something that comes to life, that is real and visceral, of the experience of what our forefathers said.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.